Welcome back to the show. My guest today is Skinner Lane. Skinner is the founder and chairman of Exosphere, a learning and problem-solving community and startup laboratory. I was introduced to Skinner by previous guest of the show and friend, Moritz Bierling. Moritz has studied with Skinner for some time and thought he would be a great guest to have on the show to help us bridge the narrative of collapse that we've been developing over the previous couple of episodes, bridge that gap into something more empowering, more optimistic, and perhaps even a little bit exciting, a way of making sense of the planetary transition that might reveal it to be an opportunity in disguise. And I really couldn't be happier with how this conversation turned out. I think it's illuminating in all the right ways, while still being very grounded in the dire nature of the situation we collectively find ourselves in. So I think you're really going to enjoy this one. And without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Skinner Lane. The Emerge podcast is proud to be sponsored by the Monastic Academy for the Preservation of Life on Earth. The Monastic Academy, located in Lowell, Vermont, is a training center dedicated to the amplification of human maturity in the age of the Anthropocene. The Academy trains its participants through a unique combination of rigorous contemplative training, project-based learning, and a disciplined commitment to ethical behavior, all held in the context of deep community. The Monastic Academy is currently accepting applications for the apprenticeship program. This program, lasting 2 or 3 months, includes silent retreats, daily meditation instruction, and regular authentic relating practices. This program is free. Other ways to participate include daily visits, week-long retreats, or, if you can work remotely, joining the Academy through the co-working program, allowing you to deepen your practice while keeping your job. For more information, you can go to www.monasticacademy.com. I mean, one of the things that I was struck by in our kind of pre-call yesterday is that you said that you've been, I don't know how exactly you framed it, but that you've been in the collapse camp for the past 20 years. And I'm curious if you could describe like how it is that you entered into that kind of perspective and how that's evolved over the past 20 years for you.
Well, I guess what I always tell people is that I'm a recovering libertarian, and that it is sort of like being an alcoholic. You know, it's never completely gone. And what I mean by that is that I started reading Hayek, and people like Friedman when I was 14 or 15 years old, and then I started getting into the people that were writing around that libertarian economic space more contemporarily. And a lot of those people have been sort of lifelong collapsers. So I was exposed to this. It was not inconsistent with the, the sort of rough life mentality that my farm upbringing kind of put into my soul. I grew up in rural Northwest Arkansas on a blueberry farm, and my family had been farmers on my dad's side of the family, I guess going back to whenever they came over from the homeland. So my father's side of the family, at least I know, had been in the States since the 1760s. At least that was when the first first Lane was born on American soil. So I guess there's this like deep-rooted sense of that life is hard, and if life isn't hard, then there you must be missing something. Like there must be some detail that you've overlooked. I think that suspicion has just been with me in every little circumstance of my life, which is if things are too good, that something must be wrong. Which, you know, is probably not so great in certain aspects as far as being pleasant company to be around. But long term thinking, I actually think it's a pretty helpful paradigm, because if we examine the origins of life all the way down to tiny organisms, energy is difficult to acquire, very, very expensive to conserve, and you never know when you're going to run out. And I think that this is, you know, whatever, however we think about contemporary economic problems, all of economics is at its basis energy accounting. That's what it is that there is a certain amount of energy that has to be expended to live, and then more energy if that living is going to be something above subsistence, and then we have to expend energy to acquire energy. There's no such thing as free energy. And so as a result, we are always, by definition, living in a world or a universe of relative scarcity of energy. So no matter what we do, we will never escape that reality. And I think that theologically, this is what is my interpretation of the Genesis account, the metaphor of the Genesis account of creation and the fall and being expelled from the garden. There's this interesting thing, this curse of the ground, as it's frequently referred to, where of course everybody's familiar with Eve's punishment of the pain of childbirth, and often forget Adam's punishment, which is that he has to work the ground in order to live, and that this will be pretty much tough and miserable. That's the way that this story goes. I think that that's like this idea, the curse of the ground, is, you know, maybe more appropriately the curse of energy not being free. And that it just won't ever be free. And so what we can do, we can expand the efficiency of our energy acquisition mechanisms, and we can improve the conservation of energy through, you know, ways of conserving or economizing the energy itself. If you think of at the level of electricity, you know, we run refrigerators. Well, one of the ways that we could make refrigerators cheaper in their totality of their life cycle is to make them use less electricity to produce the same amount of coal. The underlying principle of that is the underlying principle of every single imaginable part of our economic life. And so if you start with the assumption that energy is free or near free and should be, you're just going to have a bad life. Or you're going to have you're going to have a fine life until suddenly you realize that that isn't true, or that the unusual circumstances that temporarily made that seem to be true are now suddenly no longer true. And you've spent however many years not preparing yourself for the time in which that would happen, then that's going to be particularly miserable existence after that point. So when we talk about collapse narratives, I think what we really are talking about is not the collapse of civilizations. I think that these kind of things in some sense, you know, there's never, like, Rome didn't collapse. It just morphed into something else. And you know, we have evidence of civilizations that did completely collapse and disappeared, but you know, more often than not, the great civilizations just transitioned to some other form of civilization run by some other people, but they didn't start over from scratch. And I can't really imagine a scenario in which we start over from complete scratch, like back to hunting and gathering. It seems like a very, very unlikely set of improbable events would have to all occur at the same time to push us that far back. So I think that what the collapse narrative really is that people who have grown up in the post-Second World War West became accustomed to a certain kind of lifestyle that came about more or less easily to them because the costs of acquiring that energy were being externalized onto some third party or to nature. And now the bill has come in and nobody wants to pay it. And I think that feels like collapse to people who were accustomed to the other thing. So basically all economizing behavior is rooted in a desire to get the things that we need to survive or be comfortable with less energy or with less expensive energy. And the post-war era and people who came up in the post-war era, my grandparents' generation, they grew up in the Depression. There's this, you know, I think really significant generational difference between the mentality of everything is scarce and very hard to acquire and this attitude that we have for everybody that's come up since the Second World War ended in the West, that it's like things are relatively easy to acquire.
Right.
And the reason that we, so if you came up in that mindset, the baby boomer millennial or Gen X millennial, Gen Z people, those four generations in the West thought, okay, this is so we solved our real problems and now look how easy life is. And the only reason that life was that easy is that the costs of the energy that was used to make life easy were being externalized onto third parties, mostly people in the developing world and nature, and the future. I mean, very importantly, the future, in multiple senses, you know, not just this sort of actuarial timetable of when the costs, the financial costs are coming due, but all the other costs as well.
That it's sort of like this, trust fund child that they wake up, they're born, and their first realization is that everything they want is just given to them. And then this creates a certain attitude about life that if one day the money runs out, there are lots of, movie tropes about this kind of scenario. And I think that's sort of what's happened on a generational scale. Of course, with not as much money, but as for for the individual, but by historical standards, everybody who was born after the Second World War in the West has basically enjoyed a level of spending so incommensurate with the level of productive work. That then suddenly when the accounts have to be rectified, people are panicked and our political system is looked at as the locus of responsibility for creating the conditions for permanent economic growth under this sort of the paradigm that we've had. And if we look at the ideologies that came out of the Enlightenment, what I call the children of the Enlightenment. There are really three ideologies that came out of the Enlightenment: fascism, Marxism, and consumerism. Mm. And fascism require, I mean, as with all modern ideologies, and if you look at the French Revolution as kind of if the Enlightenment is the father of these modern ideologies, the French Revolution is the mother of them, because the French revolutionaries did a lot of really strange things. Like, they changed the calendar to a 10-day week because 7 was an irrational number of days to have in a week. And, you know, within a year, basically all of the livestock in France had died, because it turns out that about every 7 days or so, animals need, you know, work animals need to rest. Mm. There were a lot of these views of the French revolutionaries and the other people that had been steeped in Enlightenment philosophy, that there was this old backward way that we had been doing things that didn't make any sense. And so we just dump it all wholesale and start from scratch, and then we'll be really smart and rational. And so all three of these ideologies bear this feature. So, which is that everything has to be, like, we have to start over from scratch. Otherwise, we don't get the benefits. And so it's very important to understand how that, I think, came about in order to realize how we got into the position that we're in right now. So, you know, fascism died suddenly of a heart attack. Basically, it's such an unsustainable system because it's predicated on a total falsification of the historical narrative. You like all of history, like, there must be a narrative of history that is leading up to this moment of the present where we can finally break free of, you know, and you fill in, like, you could sort of have a fill in the blank fascism for however, you know, any society, you could just have a nice little fill in the blank fascism. But the problem is that when you have the requirement of falsifying history, then everybody who's participating in advancing the ideology is also participating in the falsification of history. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up with is the collective version of the phenomenon of the pathological liar. Mm. Where, because the pathological liar doesn't, at some point he loses the ability to distinguish between truth and lie, because he's lied so many times about so many things that, like, the mind can't handle that kind of cognitive dissonance with integrity. Mm. And so the mind literally begins to disintegrate. And so fascism basically creates a scenario where you have a society that is a pathological liar. And so if you have that kind of system, you can't do things like build atomic bombs. Because, like, science requires truth-seeking behavior. And so if you corrupt an entire society with constant need to falsify history, including recent and especially recent history, and everybody is held in check by the immediate threat of violence, then you end up with a scenario where everybody is lying to everybody all the time about everything. Hmm. And it's very hard to win wars like that. And because there's no personal loyalty, because everything is being held in check by the marginal threat of violence, you also end up with spies and captured military personnel who just, you know, spill their guts about everything. Like, they have no need at that moment to keep the secret anymore. Mm. So when you organize society that way, it just doesn't last very long. And it's important to see that Marxism, on the other hand, has a much longer life cycle. It still ends very badly, but it has a much longer life cycle, because it creates a false narrative of history, but it's a very narrow false narrative. So they say, well, really, like history is what it is, but it's, but history is the story of this. So rather than saying that there's this one real history, like fascism does, what Marxism does is it adapts the historical narrative to its ideological point. Hmm. So it's a different kind, it's a softer form of falsification. And it does so in a way that creates very deep personal loyalties. So where Nazi spies would, if captured, basically just spill the beans immediately, you couldn't torture Soviet personnel longer hard enough to get the details. Like they would really take them to their grave. And but Marxism eventually breaks down whenever the so where we said that fascism dies of a heart attack, Marxism dies of cancer, because eventually there are just too many non-producing cells for whatever number of producing cells there are. And then the organism just like consumes itself.
Right.
And you know, this can of course be accelerated if you are particularly intentionally incompetent like Venezuela. But like on the whole, it should take about a century. Mm. And I think that, you know, or, you know, let's say 75 years, more or less. Mm-hmm. So like we're in fact seeing, you know, like Cuba, that got started a bit later than the Russians with socialism, is sort of at this stage of total collapse now. So they're able to keep things going for a while, but then at a certain point that you just don't have enough people producing and it can't sustain. So we come to our present context, which is this third ideology. And it's a sort of, it's a strange ideology because it poses as a non-ideology.
Right.
And consumerism is the most brilliant of all ideologies because it pretends not to be an ideology. Mm-hmm. It pretends just to be local optimization. But local optimization is an ideology, and it carries a very deep ethical framework. It is not an ethical framework that is consistent with mine, but it is its own system of ethics. And so where fascism needs to totally falsify the historical narrative and rewrite history, and where Marxism reformulates history around a single ideological point, consumerism just says history. What history? Like, why are you worried about stuff that's old and dead? Like, here, buy this Coca-Cola.
Right.
And you know, and so the problem with this is that you is this very peculiar law of human nature, and law of economics called the law of diminishing returns, or the law of decreasing marginal utility. Mm. So each Coca-Cola that you tell me to buy gives me less utility than the previous Coca-Cola that I bought. And so you either have to keep inventing new flavors of Coca-Cola or like new sizes. You have to keep, you know, upsizing, right, because of this law of decreasing marginal utility. And so eventually, consumerism always would die of diabetes, and almost just literally, because you just overconsume, and die of overconsumption rather than underconsumption in the case of Marxism at the end of its game. And so, like, but consumerism is also very clever because it. Of course, I'm anthropomorphizing here. I know that consumerism doesn't have a brain, but you know, it's for the purposes of narrative storytelling, we will give them personalities. Consumerism sort of saw its older brothers die pretty nasty deaths and decided that it didn't want to die that kind of nasty death. But it also did see like what made each of them work. So it saw that the language of egalitarianism that came from Marxism, that's a really that's a good aesthetic. Mm. Everybody feels equal. And everything is kind of bland looking, and so like you reduce a lot of costs by making everything bland looking. But the fascists, they were really, really good at industrial production. So the way I frame it is that that consumerism is fascist production with communist aesthetics. And no company better symbolizes that than Apple. I mean, Apple is the perfection of fascist production and Marxist aesthetics. I mean, if you think about the like total blandness of the iPhone and the way that it's marketed, it's just that instead of it being, it's a sort of a very peculiarly Americanized version of Marxism. So instead of calling it the WePhone, they call it the iPhone because Americans are particularly narcissistic. So, but everybody gets to have their own iPhone. Yeah. So it like, it's still this kind of Marxist aesthetic at the end. But just, you know, extra dose of narcissism to make it palatable to the American, palate. So the thing is that you can't just consume and consume and consume without commensurate levels of increased production. So this wouldn't have lasted for very long. Under normal conditions, but then but two things happened. The first thing that happened was the invention of the silicon chip. We just cannot even begin to comprehend how groundbreaking this invention is still today to us. I mean, we take the technology for granted, and I think even the people that invented it didn't really realize how big of an invention it was. I mean, I don't think you could. I don't think it's possible to realize how utterly world-changing this single one invention has been. It's because so much human energy went into information transfer, like information storage and transfer. And the top mind, like if you were above average intelligence person, for most of history, you could guarantee yourself job security if you were literate and able to do competent informational transfer, or other kind of informational work. So, you know, this is why we have this idea of, you know, smart people going into public affairs historically, or serving as clerks to important officials, because there was this massive amount of computation and informational transfer that had to be done inside of human minds. And then suddenly all of those minds were freed up because we don't need them to do that anymore. And we could process so much more information because IQ was no longer a bottleneck to informational production. So in the past, there was a natural constraint to how much could be done with information. And that constraint was the number of brains that could do informational processing work, which was just not very many, because it requires a lot of focus, concentration, and discipline. And so there are just not that many people that have those things all in one package. And so if you could afford to hire people that could do that kind of work, then you basically controlled some significant amount of political power and economic power in your geographic region. Well, the silicon chip blew that just wide open. Now suddenly everybody could afford informational work. Everybody. And Moore's law has guaranteed that the access to that informational processing capability has just increased and become cheaper and cheaper. And so this is what has enabled consumerism to go on as, like, this is the first major event that has allowed the current system to go on as long as it has. The second event was the end of the final end of the gold window in the 70s, when Nixon told the French that he was not really interested in giving them the gold that the Bretton Woods Agreement had entitled them to. And so this detachment from sound money meant that nobody was actually paying attention to the accounting anymore at all, because you didn't need to, because money wasn't scarce. It was now abundant. It just couldn't be too abundant, or you'd get hyperinflation really quickly. So this is where the Federal Reserve starts to become this godlike entity that is supposed to allow us to continue cheating the accounting, but not so much that we have problems, but not so little that we have to start paying attention to the accounting again, which is a Scylla and Charybdis kind of scenario that occasionally goes awry and you get stock market crashes. So I think all of this is important to kind of set the stage for the collapse narrative that we're living, because we need to, if we want to respond positively and ethically to a negative and unethical set of circumstances, we ought to at least know how we got here.
Yes.
Because otherwise we will just, we might repeat some of the same old mistakes. We might blame the wrong people. And all of these kind of things. Whereas if we know kind of how we got here and what our real options are going forward, then it's not so much collapse as I was mentioning at the beginning, but we can transition to something else. It won't look like what we have now, but it doesn't need to be. Preserving the status quo also doesn't seem too exciting to me, because I'm not particularly happy about the status quo. I mean, like, if we just said, okay, well, one for one, we can transition out of the current circumstances into what feels like the same set of circumstances, but we've suddenly solved for the environment, I still wouldn't be happy with that. Like, that would still not be a just and fair world. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's important to spend some time with the causes, because nobody chose it. This is the other important point to make about how history happens, is that we look back on history and make certain kind of judgments, and we imbue agency to people who didn't really have it. We say, well, this generation chose this, when in fact they didn't really choose it. It's just that they were faced with a certain set of options, and they chose one thing instead of another, and then and this process at the margin of making decisions leads to what look like historical decisions, but aren't really. Yeah. Like, they're just, we decided to keep going on the same path we were on at each step rather than turning around. So, and I think that's a good way to look at it, is that if you are if you're hiking and you're on a trail, and you're walking on the wrong trail, and you walk on the wrong trail for 2 hours, how would you describe, where did we make our mistake? Well, in essence, a new mistake was made with every step.
Right.
And that's how history happens, is that there's not one big, we look at sort of trigger events, like the assassination of the Archduke of Austria-Hungary is the cause of the First World War. But, it's what sparked an inevitable war based on all the other things that had been happening for 100 years. Yes. And so similarly, and nobody chose, it's not like people sat around and chose the events that led to the Second World War either. So we don't get to make these choices. we don't get to choose. I hate the phrase "the wrong side of history." I mean, I don't even know what this means. What it really sounds like is the wrong side of a particular group's analysis of the way things should be done in the present, in the hope that that's the way things actually are done in the future, so that people can be judged retrospectively. But that's kind of a weird thing to be optimizing for.
Yeah. Well, so I think I agree, and this is something that we've explored on the show before, is sort of, we might say, how collapse itself is woven into the DNA of our current system. And as you say, you know, we're kind of we've been paying for the present with the natural world and with the future, broadly speaking. And it seems like, from my perspective, based on the conversations I've had, that like that check is coming due, right? Like that buffer is quickly running out. And one, I'm curious if that matches with your kind of forecasting, if we are kind of reaching some kind of precipice. And then the other piece I'd be curious to hear you speak about is like, if we kind of accept this collapse narrative as being somehow accurate, I think a lot of people who have been paying attention to this conversation hear that and then kind of reify this idea of collapse as a kind of singularity or event horizon that once we enter into, just like everything is shit forever. I think it's important that we sort of nuance and complexify like what collapse could actually look like on the ground in reality for us. And I know that you have some perspectives on that. So would love to hear you reflect on those pieces.
I think, well, the very last stanza of T.S. Eliot's poem, The Hollow Man, it says, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but with a whimper." And I think that this is a good place, good way to start to answer your question. So I don't buy into this sort of event horizon metaphor, this point of no return, even things like precipice. I think that collapse is more like falling down a hill than falling off a cliff. And so, you know, you are rolling down a hill and you roll through some, you know, brambles and then you catch yourself on a tree and you sort of sit there for a while bleeding from the scratches from the brambles. And then all of a sudden, you know, this precarious resting position that you have found suddenly breaks loose and you fall another few meters and, you know, hit your head on a rock. And then, you know, and there's a long way to the bottom. And each step along the way, it's like, okay, finally, this is, at least this is the new normal. And then, oh no, there's like a little bit more and a little bit more. And so I think that the resting position of this for the West is basically that all of the West becomes Brazil, which is that, like, I lived in Brazil. I lived in South America for 11 years, and I love Brazil. I would love to have stayed in Brazil, but for the reasons I'm about to say, I didn't, which is that, like, Brazil is a sort of maddeningly functional country, but not optimally functional. And you look around and you say, oh, but like there are all of these great people and they're extremely nice and they seem to have, they're very smart, they're very inventive, creative, etc. But then, like, why can't things just work? why can't they work well and smoothly?
Yeah.
And if you try to explore this, you don't get any satisfying answers. Well, it's the corruption, it's this, it's that, and then it's always been this way, and we don't know how to make it not this way anymore. And I think that that's actually what collapse looks like, is that you just sort of bounce from one crisis to another, and never with enough resilience to slow down the frequency of the crises and build up enough infrastructure to meaningfully keep them at bay. So if you think about the Dutch, they're very good engineers because they've had to be very good engineers to keep their underwater country not underwater.
yeah, right.
And you know, the reason it works is that, you know, I'm sure that in the early days they were not like everything took all the effort they had just to keep from being underwater. And if you only put out just enough effort to preserve that sort of status quo level of acceptability, then you'll spend, you know, every generation after you will continue being in the exact same position. Mm-hmm. So the only way that you prevent that and free up resources to do other things is you say, well, we're going to solve this problem. We're going to oversolve the problem. We're going to put out more energy than we need to for today in order that people who are not us will get the benefit of us having expended that energy. So it means that we have to produce more than we will ever consume in order to prevent the problem from recurring in that way. And then as long as we maintain that infrastructure, we won't have to go through that phase again. Well, you can see how that's just completely incompatible with consumerism. Mm-hmm. Because you have to be able to think in time in order to keep the proverbial ocean at bay. And now this is, you know, unfortunately probably going to be less metaphorical as the climate continues to change and so forth. Like a lot of people are actually going to just literally be having to keep the ocean at bay. So, but the point here is that the incompatibility with our current ideology is that I have to put out energy for an outcome that I don't get to benefit from. And when the only thing I've consumed media for, like, as far as information is concerned, since the time I was born, was marketing. Then how in the world am I going to come to the decision to put out more? Because marketing is all like, it's this simple. You buy this thing and your problem is solved, and you start to confuse reality from image. And this is, of course, why the Abrahamic religions and, you know, the Ten Commandments starts out with a prohibition against making images of anything, not just of God. So that would be a misreading of it. Like, no images. And then they even list, like, no images of this and that and none of that either, and no creeping things or crawling things. And, you know, it's like really, really clear, no images. And I think a lot of this is because there's this recognition that images cause people to lose the ability to make distinctions between what's real and what's not real. So if you've been inundated with that image-based stimulation telling you, do this thing for yourself, and that's all the information you've been able to consume from childhood, and then suddenly there are these algorithms that are perfected to give you specialized manipulation.
Right.
Every second that you have your screen on, how are you going to come to the conclusion that you have to do something that nobody else is doing and pay for something that nobody else is currently paying for the benefit of somebody you probably won't meet? And that's why that's why consumerism is just as self-defeating as fascism and Marxism. Because you lose the, like, my definition of civilization is the willingness to pay for garbage collection and preventative maintenance. And, you know, nobody wants to pick up trash. Nobody wants to do maintenance that's not needed. Why not just wait? Well, so fascism makes it impossible to do maintenance and garbage collection. Marxism makes it where you don't have the resources to do it. And consumerism causes the loss of will to do it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So I really like the analogy of collapse being like falling down a hill instead of falling off a precipice. I think that's really rich and would, you know, what comes to mind then is like, how do we prepare ourselves to fall down a hill, you know, well, without, you know, smashing. Yeah. And if you just extend the analogy a little bit, like there's a way to fall that protects your vital organs, that maybe you kind of fall over towards where it's a little bit safer and less dangerous, but it, you know, how, and I know that you're working on this a lot through Exosphere, like how do we become the kinds of people that can, you know, we're not going to escape collapse because we're embedded in these systems that are to some degree kind of terminal right now, but we can embrace the situation and become responsive agents who can, you know, act skillfully in the midst of collapse. So what is your thinking on that? How do we become those kinds of people?
Well, I would even say that, I mean, I would say the first step is if you know that the end state of whatever is about to happen is you being at the bottom of that hill, and you still have some choice in the matter. You know, you could climb down it instead of being pushed down it. And I think that, so like the starting point of my response, you know, using this extended metaphor, is that like there is still a lot of time. I mean, I think we are already seeing consequences of the various forms of collapse, and we'll just see more of them. I really don't think there's going to be this sudden event, which is not satisfying, you know, to a lot of people. They're just like, okay, let's have a big, horrible thing, and then it's over with, and then we know.
Where's the zombie apocalypse, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just not going to be that way. Like, it's not going to be nearly as satisfying as The Walking Dead. And so at any moment you could be pushed down this hill, I think is the way to think about it. Like you individually could be pushed down this hill at any moment and you don't know. So like whatever you're doing in your life right now, every minute you keep doing that, you're taking the risk that somebody will push you down this hill. And whereas if you get pushed, then, you know, who knows how exactly that fall is going to take place and, you know, what kind of recovery you're going to have to go through once you hit the bottom. But you could choose right now to start climbing down the hill strategically and going down the places, you know, with fewer briars and avoid the hitting your head on the rocks and so forth. So the first step is to just understand that there's never going to be a moment when it's going to be clear that now is the moment to make the change for you individually.
Right.
There's not like, it's just that every minute that goes by, the risk is going up by some amount and you don't know how much. We're living, like living in a collapse scenario means that we are living in a, by definition, a state of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who talk about collapse talk about it almost joyfully because they think that there is an end state of certainty. And that's what they're even looking forward to the collapse because then at least things will be certain and settled. Like they're like whatever the new system will be, we'll know, and then we won't have to like worry about the future anymore. It is not dissimilar from the attitude of that causes a lot of people to commit suicide, which is, well, like, yes, things could get better, but they could get worse, and I don't like not knowing, so there's a way out. And so I think that a lot of this like kind of fetishizing collapse rhetoric that we see is from people that they just don't want to live in an uncertain world. But you know, I am sorry to break it to them. It's never certain. Like there's never been a world in which things were you had that kind of certainty.
Yeah.
So in order to prepare yourself for increasing levels of uncertainty rather than increasing levels of certainty, the first step is to say, I'm going to climb down that hill without falling, whatever it takes. And now I spent a lot of time doing wilderness backpacking, and I spent my summers in college in Alaska doing super wilderness backpacking. And you know, one of the things that you do differently after the first time that you go is you realize how much less stuff you actually needed. Because carrying all of that stuff is just, it you know, day three, you're like, wow, why did I pack that? and then, you know, you can't just leave it out there in nature. Yeah. So you have to keep carrying the dead weight with you. So I think that, you know, the first thing to do, if you're going to descend a pretty steep mountain and there's a lot of hazards on the way down, is the very first thing that you do is say, okay, I need to go down there. I have to go down there. I don't have a choice. And now how much stuff do I really need to take with me?
Right.
And well, you know, if it doesn't fit in my backpack, it probably is going to be too much trouble to carry. Now I'm speaking metaphorically, but you know, there's definitely the physical aspect of this that's also kind of true, which is if you're tied to a bunch of physical stuff, life is just more complicated. But I'm talking about beliefs and assumptions about the world and relationships and like a lot of things that tie people to the top of the mountain. And those people, you know, if it's relationships, then, you know, maybe you can convince the people you care about to go down with you. Like that's probably the best outcome. And the good thing is that it's not quite like the literal mountain in that, you know, you can go on down and you can still maintain contact with all those people in the meantime. And then they might decide later to go down too. You don't have to leave them completely, you know, behind. But so there's all this stuff that you have to decide. And then along the way, you have to keep deciding. Like you that's the other unpleasant thing going on as you go down, is you start to realize, oh, wait, I took this thing that I shouldn't have taken. Maybe I could just leave it here. And so forth. And so, you know, from my perspective, the process of climbing down looks like empowered self-production. How do I, and I don't mean on an individual scale, because I think that wealth is ultimately division of labor. You can't have this mythical guy in the cabin in Montana thing. Like that's not what I'm talking about here. When I talk about off the grid, or what we call the off-grid stack of technology at Exosphere, I'm not talking about the guy in his cabin in Montana. I'm talking about resilient communities, local production that is as detached from the global supply chain as possible. So if we think about like a lot of the things that cause people to fall down the hill, they are these moments when you suddenly can't get access to something that you need. It's just not available, or you can't afford, you can no longer afford it. You could afford it before, and then suddenly you can't afford it. And at the moment when you realize that you need something that you can't afford or it's not available, you either have to figure out how to make it yourself or how to do without it. And so I mean, if you take the literal zombie apocalypse, you know, in watching The Walking Dead or something like that, you sort of see, and I think the show actually does a very good job of showing how things deteriorate over time, even after, like even once they've accepted that there are, you know, all these zombies around trying to eat them, things still get worse.
Yeah,
right. Like it's not like, okay, well, now at least we're in this great, you know, this unpleasant situation where we know that zombies are coming for us, but at least now that's the certainty. No, because, you know, first they're foraging, they're going out and, you know, raiding warehouses of goods, but then certain things just no longer exist. Like at a certain point, there aren't going to be any pharmacies left to take medicine from.
Yes.
And then what do you do? And at a certain point, you know, there are all of these little things like cleaning products and other things like this. You get one major disruption to a global supply chain, and then suddenly there's some good that you just can't get. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, at some level, we're always going to have certain things that we won't be able to get. Like, there are not a lot of places where you can grow bananas. So, you know, there may very legitimately come a time when you just can't get bananas anymore. Either because the bananas have been destroyed through this fungal infection that is wiping out all the bananas because of monoculture, or because the global supply chain has somehow failed in that particular way and you just can't get bananas. Well, bananas maybe are not the thing that you need to care so much about. my point is that the list of those things is really, really long. And so you can't prepare for those. But then there's this other list of essentials. So, you know, 3D printing is rapidly going to make it possible. I mean, it's already being done in very small scale laboratory settings, but to 3D print pills. Mm. You know, you could 3D print ibuprofen, for example. So if you're really concerned about the collapse, then learning about these technologies that can produce things in a decentralized way with locally sourceable raw materials, then you're much more resilient to the negative things that happen, not just because you can provide for yourself, but because you create communities of value where value can be exchanged within the community and so forth. So we have this extraordinary heritage. I mean, it is a literal inheritance from the last 250, 300 years of scientific and technological progress. And just like profit taking in the stock market, if you have highly leveraged financial positions in the stock market, at a certain point you say, let's take some profit, let's sell, get the money off the table, and at least we know we have that money now. And I think technology operates in somewhat the same way at a civilizational scale. So we have had several hundred years of technological progress, and it's very highly leveraged progress at this point. So if you get there's the sort of famous example that the level of complexity required to make a pencil is now like beyond the scope of somebody being able to make one from scratch. What we need to do is do some profit taking in our technology stack. In other words, we retool the technology stack in a way that it could sustain a lot longer. We could continue benefiting from it even if the current systems of its implementation go away. So there are very few things that we couldn't produce on a decentralized in a decentralized manner. I mean, even silicon chips. It's a very hard technical problem to solve, but we could, like in theory, we could have very small scale superconductor or semiconductor production. That seems like a really great thing to be doing, or, you know, producing the hardware to make mesh networks and actually running mesh networks. Now that the internet is fragmenting and we're going to have a very draconian, over-regulated internet in Europe, that will, like, I'm afraid in the end it might even make China look lightweight by regulatory comparison. There's already the Chinese internet, there's already the Russian internet, and we're just going to see more and more fragmentation of this. Well, think technologies like mesh networks are a way for people to overcome the centralized infrastructure and still be able to communicate with each other. I see mesh networks as sort of the ham radio of our generation. Nice. And so the ability to, like, having the skill in a distributed basis for the construction and maintenance of the both hardware and software of those kind of networks, like that is those skill sets are going to be very highly valued. The ability to do distributed medicine, basic medical procedures, and like all of this knowledge we could distribute much more widely than is currently distributed. And I think that acquiring those skills, that information, this is the best way to prepare oneself in kind of practical terms for going down this mountain. But I think that there's the psychological or spiritual or psycho-spiritual element of it as well, which is that none of this, like a lot of this is going to be quite unpleasant. Like if you're living just for material rewards, and when I say material rewards, I don't just mean stuff. Like I mean Instagram pictures in certain, you know, nice looking locations, or like those are like we live in the most bizarre situation where materialism has even become immaterial. We have this weird materialist culture that is now abstracted away from physical reality.
Yeah.
Extremely strange. So if you're optimizing for those kind of rewards, then you're probably going to have a hard time going down the mountain, because those rewards are just not going to be as prevalent, and they're going to be harder to acquire. And I think that this is, I mean, I think this to me is actually the silver lining of the collapse, which is that I think people are going to be driven back home to their central solitude, as Emerson puts it, and shun all of these attempts to gain credit, you know, power, prestige, and pleasure. The three-headed opposition to a Trinitarian deity would be power, pleasure, and prestige. And these are like the easiest things to optimize for. And because like that's just those are the that's human what human nature drives us to optimize for. And as primates. And so I think that this like the circumstances we're going through are waking people up to the fact that that's not the right optimization pattern. The closing stanza of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which the poem is a very good critique of modernity. I think that it's a little bit dated because of the industrial references, but you could just, you know, replace the metaphors of the soot falling from the smog with, you know, the light pollution of iPhones, and the poem would stick together pretty well anyway. And it's sort of talking about the banality and absurdity of modern life, and the shallowness of our social relationships. And it ends with this very haunting passage. It says, "We have lingered in the chambers of the seas with sea girls wreathed in seaweed red and brown till human voices wake us and we drown." And I sort of think about, I visualize the scene of a couple of people few feet below the surface of some lake or body of water, and with their eyes closed and kind of falling, like sinking down, and then all of a sudden their eyes open and they realize how deep they are, and like the violent thrashing that would occur if you had, you know, somehow were able to kind of be asleep falling below the surface of water and then suddenly realize what had happened. And I think that that's more or less the state of a person when they wake up today and realize how bad things have gotten. And then they go through this grieving process, the five stages. We can sort of see how social media has amplified people's grieving processes. And I got tired of being with all of them, and I left Facebook and Twitter as a result. But I think that's sort of the way that I'm thinking about this, is that there's you have to prepare yourself economically, but you also have to prepare yourself spiritually.
Yeah. And one thing that's coming to mind is a previous conversation I've had on the show with this person named Bonita Roy, and she has this kind of equation for what power is. And she calls it, or she says that it's skills and resources over needs and wants, right? And so you can increase your power by learning new skills that are actually appropriate for the context, like perhaps building and maintaining mesh networks. But you could also increase your power by needing and wanting less. And in fact, if you need and want for nothing, then you're in a state of extreme power. And that's, to some degree, what was underneath my motivation to come to the monastery was just like, I could see this future coming where I couldn't depend on any material substance for my happiness, for my well-being. So I wanted to go somewhere where I would learn to be happy independent of conditions, or at least with increasingly fewer particular conditions. And so, this idea in the metaphor of willingly walking to the bottom of the hill, I think there's a way in which living in contexts like a monastery or wilderness hiking, or just kind of like putting yourself in these situations where you have to deal with less, we have to kind of detox from the false abundance of our current society, is a really good piece of advice, because if that's ripped from you before you're ready, before you've ever been without it, that is exactly like what you're describing in that poem. That's terrifying. On the other hand, if you're in a position where you can let it go by your own volition, it actually becomes quite beautiful, because you realize you didn't actually want that in the first place. It wasn't satisfying. And so, it's this really interesting position that we're in now, where we can use this growing recognition of collapse to fuel what we probably should have done anyways, but maybe we just didn't have the motivation.
Right. And this, I think, is why I was alluding at the beginning of the conversation to my upbringing on the farm, because I think that there are centuries and centuries of farming, that there's a certain kind of mentality and information that's passed down of that look, that life is not easy. It's not going to be easy. There's basically nothing you can do to make it easy either. And doing without, because you don't need it, and not just because you can't. This came a bit more naturally to me because of that farm upbringing. And it's also, I think, one of the reasons that I wanted to live in the developing world, and did for 11 years, and I very bittersweet in leaving. But I find that people in Latin America, outside of the very upper class, and people in Eastern Europe, where I've also spent a lot of time, the decadent mentality that we've been talking about throughout this call has been delayed basically one full generation in those places. And I haven't really spent any time in Africa or Asia, but I assume that you would find kind of similar thing. And so I think that there are people, a lot of people in the West, that because of the particular places that they were put in the West, didn't have quite the privilege that you would have if you had come up in the States or in France or Italy or something. And they still have a bit more of this rugged mentality about the way you survive in life. And I found it just more comforting to be in that kind of environment, because I wasn't fighting as much. But I noticed over the course of time that I was there, the gradual rot of consumerism spreading, it's a virus that will keep spreading until there's no host left for it. And this is also why all of modernity is just the repeat of Rome, but with technology. Expand until there's no place left to expand and then collapse. So that's also why I think that this isn't an overnight thing, because there's still a lot of people in the world that haven't yet, bought a lot of stuff. And so that there's going to be a drive to sell them that stuff as long as it still makes sense to try to sell it to them. And that stuff comes with a lifestyle attitude that is also what we've been talking about. The consumption as the priority over production, and a mentality of things being a certain way. And well, these are the ethical compromises you have to make in order to live in the world. So in the same way, at the same time that this narrative is collapsing in the US and Europe, it's still rising in the developing world. So it creates a very unusual set of circumstances in which to, as far as the, I think that today it's somewhat easier to convince somebody in San Francisco that things are falling apart than to convince somebody in Sao Paulo that things are falling apart in the same way. Because the people in Sao Paulo still think that things are going really well in San Francisco, and that's the place to imitate. And I'm really sorry to break it to you, but that place is a disaster. And then they just don't want to believe it.
Yeah.
And so it the unevenness of the way things are going will just continue to be quite uneven on both sides. And I think that's also why preparing to live in a world that is going to be more and more uncertain as the way to think about the collapse, rather than preparing for a sort of certain end state, is a much better approach.
Yeah. Well, and so I like that we both are vibing on this kind of two-part, to put it simply, approach to preparing for collapse. One is a kind of deconstructive move of letting go of your beliefs about how the world ought to be, or what I need to be happy, so on and so forth. And that's something I think that we've covered on the show before. There's lots of ways to engage in that process, self-inquiry, journaling, meditation, putting yourself in situations where you just don't have access to the things you think you need to be happy. But then there's this other move of kind of constructive, constructing, learning things that will conceivably be useful in this time of great uncertainty. You mentioned learning how to build and maintain mesh networks. That's a very tangible skill. I'm curious, what other tangible skills are you seeing as being kind of fundamental? Mm-hmm. And, how do you kind of, where would you look to start to be tapped into that kind of list of skills, and where would you go to learn, kind of give a whole picture, big picture of what, where you would go, how you orient to that question?
Well, I would say top of the list of practical skills would be gardening. They're very simple equation, dirt plus water equals food. And it's been a pretty functional equation for as long as there has been terrestrial life on Earth, and it will continue to be the case, Like where there is clean water and clean soil and sun, you'll get food. There may be fewer places where you can do that, but wherever that equation is possible, it will work. And so much of and then you know the sort of corollary to that is learn how to prepare food, if you and how to preserve food. I consider these kind of things kind of pretty basic. Learn how to, and then you know either decide you're going to become a vegetarian, or determine that you're going to also learn how to deal with animals. I don't know a lot of people in my generation from the background that I came from, even farming people, a lot of the kids didn't learn how to kill and gut a chicken and prepare it for eating or, you know, whatever else. Well, so if you want to continue that part of a lifestyle, then you've got to, like, those skills are going to be valuable. And I don't want to be misinterpreted. I'm not saying that there's going to become some moment where you can't get these things in the grocery store or, you know, some other person to do it. What I'm saying is that if we're looking at this equation of about wants and needs as the denominator there, and you want to lower the value of that denominator, well, one of the things that you can do is to not need to buy food externally, and that makes you, like, if you have covered your food and housing situation where you don't have a monthly payment to either of those things, you could really do you could have quite a life with just those two things. Like, you don't need a lot more. I mean, energy is, like, electricity is nice, but it's also not necessary. And there are ways, of course, to produce electricity as well. So I think, like, just understanding options of, okay, with what I have, what could I grow? With what I have access to in the short term, what are the way, how could I produce some of my own food? You could do this in, like, patio garden, pots even. And there are lots of ways to hydroponics, etc. So just, like, educating yourself generally about what the possibilities are when it comes to food production, I think is a good starting point. I think that the same thing, like, how is energy produced? I mean, most people have no idea how electricity gets to their plug. Zero idea about the whole end-to-end process there, and what other ways we could generate electricity in smaller scale. And like, you can buy wind turbines and solar panels for your roof and all those kind of things. Well, but you should at least educate yourself on what those possibilities are. And if right now it doesn't make economic sense to do them, don't do them. Wait, but then when it becomes necessary or you need to make a change in that way, you already have the knowledge. You don't have to then go and like, whenever we have to do anything because we're forced by circumstances to do it, it's always going to cost more and be of lower quality. So planning out these kind of things and just understanding what options are on this sort of very basic things of energy, food, and housing, very good starting place. And I think that from there you start to look at skills, as I said, related to basic medical care, that are, I think, at least learning first aid is not a bad thing. If you live in Europe, you're increasingly facing, like, Europeans have gotten very spoiled from their free healthcare, and now people with means are buying private insurance because the public system is too overcrowded, and that's just going to continue to become a bigger problem. So being able to do certain kinds of basic self-care or care on, you know, friends or family to prevent going and sitting, you know, dying in a waiting room or spending an exorbitant amount of money, you know, and not, because we have to think about this as not just being life and death, but also cost. So if you save yourself certain kinds of costs in emergency settings, then, I mean, emergency costs are always very high. And then you could just sort of move through the tree of necessity, and the things that are more interesting go in that direction. I think people really should let their curiosity drive them a lot more than it does. They're trying to say, well, what should I be learning? Well, the first answer to that is learn what you're curious about. It's probably not going to lead you too far astray, because at a certain point you'll get bored. If it's not that useful, you'll lose interest and move on to something else. So there are a lot of, like I said, there's communication with mesh networks, people that are interested in coding and computers and technology, who for some reason want to have social media after the apocalypse. could definitely
you can make that happen.
Keep the thing going if that's what you want. Yeah, absolutely. But the, so I look at things like, well, transportation. Of course, now automobiles are made in such a way that you can't do much maintenance to them yourself. But now, there are a lot of open hardware movements, like the open source ecology folks are doing really great work in making open source versions of the 50 basic machines needed for civilization. So they have, a model of an open source car. And, so if you really wanted to, I don't know if they finished that one, but, if you wanted to make your own car, this is something that could be done. And if you then understand that you can manufacture crude forms of biodiesel, out of various forms of food waste, they're like a lot of these kind of things that right now wouldn't make sense to actually do. Like I'm still going to go to the gas station and put, gas in my car and pay for it, as long as that is still economically feasible. But by the time that it's not, I would like to have built up the, repository of knowledge to solve those problems myself, or inserted myself into a network or community of people inside of which there's the skill for that.
Yeah, that's something that I think I feel like I want a presence is also like this list of skills, like follow your curiosity, but also like find other people who have the skills that you aren't curious about so that together you can actually make a kind of full stack.
Right.
And that is hard for many reasons, not just because of like practical resilience, but because of like once things fall apart, I think it will reveal to us again how much satisfaction naturally comes from being embedded in a community of people that know us and care about us. And that for me has been really, really something I've seen clearer now that I've really gone into investigating this topic, is how important community is.
Yes. And I will add that the worse things get externally, the harder it is to build trust with strangers. So, I think that we are already at a point of like, we have to be nearing an historic minimum of trust between people. The fact that people are, ending friendships and breaking off contact with family over political disagreements is, I think, a pretty decent bellwether that that trust is evaporating very quickly. And so if you think about it, as all the other things accelerate, mistrust will also accelerate. And so if you find yourself in need of a community of people, if things have really gotten so bad that you need it to survive, you're probably too late. Like, not a lot of people will take you in at that point. And I don't mean, like, when I say community, I don't mean, a physical piece of property with a bunch of houses on it and everybody lives inside of some walls. I mean, I just mean like a group of people who have trust with each other. They don't need to be co-located even. But so regardless of those parameters, what I'm saying is that once it becomes necessary to be in a community of people who have this variety of skills, they will be very picky, like that. Those communities will be in a position to be very selective as to who, right. what new people right. they let in, and some might just not let anybody in because it's too risky. And I think that this is like the internet when it first, like when the consumer internet first popped up in the 90s, there was all of this lofty talk about, you know, the global village and all the trust that would be generated from this level of transparency and communication. And, you know, it lasted about 5 minutes. If we zoom out on a historical scale, is, you know, less than 5 minutes that lasted. Because, you know, it, and I think that a lot of the, I mean, I think that you could look at both the American and the European political discourse through the lens of, on the one side, there are the people still trying to keep that hope alive that universal trust between people is possible. And the people who say, well, it's never been that way before, so let's go back to the last version that we had of smaller groupings. And neither of them are really viable. Neither of the, like the, we can't go back because you just can't do that. Like there's no button on civilization that says restore to last stable release. And at the same time, we clearly can't, like, we do not have the psychological skills today to have the level of trust that the internet utopians really wanted us to already have in the 90s. And so I think that it is, I regardless of that fight, like, because I don't think either of them are right. Building the skills to be able to have trust with people who are not blood relations. I mean, I also think that that's the key point. We can't, like, we have in the West, at least, is, I don't think this is true in Asian societies or African societies and some Latin American societies, though it's starting to break apart. Like we don't in Western Europe, in the US, we don't have the like stability of blood relationships anymore. Like we detached a lot from that, and then we didn't really replace it with anything. And the skills to maintain any form of healthy human relationships are the same, whether it's blood relationships or not. It's just that for a lot of history, there was this understanding that blood relationships just had to be accepted as they were. You didn't get to choose them, and that's who you were basically stuck with. And you had to make the best of that because nobody else will take you. I mean, that's more like when I hear the phrase family values, that's actually what I hear is, well, you don't need to learn the skills of communicating like adults. You just have to accept that family is what it is, and that's who you're stuck with, and nobody else will take you. Sorry. And I don't really want to go back to living in that kind of world. So, and I don't think very many people do either. But then we really have to change our skill set with respect to communication. Yeah. I don't know a lot of people who actually communicate. And this is sort of one of the hard problems that we have been working on at Exosphere for the last 7 years. And all of the work that we've done has been built around a process of community building. And you know, we've been far from perfect in execution, but I think that it's the hard problem to solve is how do you get a group of people to actually be able to communicate honestly with each other? And it's incredibly hard because we have levels of honesty. And so we can, and I think this creates a lot of pseudo communities, a lot of people who think that they are in community with each other and they're not, because they're more open with each other than they are with the rest of the world. But there are always these corners of the psyche that are considered off limits. And well, if I shared this part of myself, surely they would kick me out. Or if this intention were known, no, like I would be a threat, or, you know, all of this list of things. And so I think very few groups of people ever achieve, you know, real true community, because it takes so much work. And there are, you know, quite frankly, a lot of other things to do and things that are not at the margin nearly as painful.
I think it's so true. And that, I mean, I think is another theme of this podcast is how to communicate in ways that we might say build coherence within a group. And in a sense, I think of coherence as true community. You know, I can say anything and that can be metabolized by the field. And so I would love perhaps to have you back on to discuss that, because it sounds like you've been doing a lot of research into that. And it's something that here at the monastery, we've been practicing a practice called circling for some time now. And sort of we feel like we have a certain level of sophistication with that. Now we're sort of figuring out what that looks like in the context of a community, instead of how it's usually practiced, which is a kind of like one-off experience or as a kind of building this vestigial muscle of how to be with other people in an honest and transparent way. And so these things also look, I think, or can look quite different when it's within a community of practice where you're living together, eating together, you know, working together. So Skinner, I really appreciate this conversation. I mean, I feel like we've kind of successfully navigated the gulf between this very difficult conversation for many people around collapse into a more empowered perspective. And in a way, I actually kind of feel excited now about collapse, because I, you know, personally, I've sort of changed the circumstances of my life, I think, to accord with a lot of what you've said. And I would love to have you back on to do another deep dive, because I think that we just scratched the surface on a lot of these topics. But curious, you know, as we close down the conversation, if there's anything you want to say to listeners that you feel like needs to be said to kind of complete this space.
Well, when you were making your remark about maybe even being excited, it sort of reminded me of my favorite movie of all time is Dr. Strangelove. You know, I guess as a cheerful apocalyptic person, it makes sense, because the subtitle of the movie is "Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb." I think that there is the funny thing about that film is that Kubrick originally was going to make it as a drama, and he decided that it was just too depressing and terrifying. Like, he couldn't do it, a drama about the end of the world with nuclear weapons. And so he turned it into a comedy. And I think that we each of us have in our psychological capability, the capacity to transform the tragedy that we may be living collectively into a comedy. I mean, a comedy in the traditional sense, not so much as the laughing and haha, but it can have a personal happy ending if we choose to push ourselves in that direction. And you know, I think that this is really one of the hardest things to accept, because we would like to just say, but shouldn't the external world just be better? And you know, the answer to that question can always be yes, of course it should. but it isn't. It is in whatever condition it is when we're born, and most of the changes that occur during our lifetime were already baked in from before we were born. And we don't get a lot. I mean, we don't get to do much to change that. But we can in fact decide what to do within that and to contribute to nudging it in a better direction so that future people have less to deal with than we did. And a lot of people might not find that much of a victory. But I'm definitely glad that other people in the past made the sacrifices they made so that I can have, you know, things like running water and antibiotics. And so, you know, the least I can do is at least try to be part of a transition from our current state of affairs to one where at least those kind of things are still there for the next generations.